Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. President Trump says he's ending DACA, a program that protects thousands of young undocumented immigrants from deportation, unless Congress acts. The Pew Hispanic Center estimates 65,000 undocumented students graduate from high schools every year in the U.S. These are children born abroad who are not citizens of the U.S. or legal residents. They are guaranteed an education in the U.S. public school through grade 12 and are eligible to attend college. Joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome Maria Rodriguez. She is an administrative assistant at Florida State University. She graduated May 2017.
Thank you for having us here today to talk about this important issue.
I'm glad to have you. Juana Delgado Hoyos, she is a senior at Florida State, and she is graduating this fall.
Yes, it's great to be here. Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
And Hudson Lana, he is a student at FSU, and he's a junior. And what are you majoring in?
Marketing and risk management.
Okay.
Insurance.
Welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you for having us.
Where do I start? I guess share with me your particular circumstances, please, before we get into the, you know, meat of the discussion.
Okay. My name is Maria Rodriguez. I was born in Colombia. At the age of 4 years old, my family and I had to move to the United States because my mom was the mayor of her town and she was receiving death threats from the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which is a terrorist group, and they eventually shot her bodyguard. So at that point, having three children, my parents saw that it was no longer safe for us to be there.
I can understand that.
And my dad was a veterinarian, and he found a position that was in Central Florida that for a dairy farm that needed a vet. And he applied, and he was hired. The employer said that he would file to sponsor my family for citizenship through employment. Mm-hmm. All we had to do was get our passport and visas and fly over. That's what we did. But unfortunately, he didn't, you know, hold up his end of the deal. He never actually filed anything. And he just kind of sold the farm and disappeared out of nowhere. So from then on, we had fallen out of status because we overstayed our visas. And it's just been a difficult journey to try to legalize ourselves because once you do fall out of status, it's almost impossible to pick that up again.
Yeah, share that a little bit more with the listening audience so they have an understanding for what that actually means when you say fall out of status.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Whenever you enter the U.S., usually you come in with a visa. Mm-hmm. You are given a time period to be here. Ours was 6 months. So at the end of 6 months, we were supposed to return to Colombia. My parents, you know, talked to their employer about that. He said it's okay because he was filing for their citizenship.
Okay.
But since that didn't actually happen, we ended up overstaying our visa. So we stayed in the country illegally.
Okay.
And there are only so many ways. There are like four ways to get citizenship. And once you overstay your visa, you're basically canceled for a lot of them. And
okay.
We could have petitioned for asylum, but that also, by the time we found out, it was too late.
Okay. All right. You're nodding your head. You want to share your experience?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Juana Delgado Hoyos, and I came here at the age of 5, so very similar to Maria, you know, very young. And I came following my dad. My mom and I came together, and we applied for political asylum. Unfortunately, when you apply for asylum, it can be very arbitrary with immigration judges. And so we were denied. And we also had, a visa that allowed us to stay for 6 months. And while we did the asylum process, we were in status. But once we were denied the asylum process, we did an appeal, and then that also got denied. And then that's when we fell out of status, which was around 2007.
Let me ask you something. When you're going through these various stages, how long does it take?
I mean, well, we arrived in 2002, and it wasn't until 2005 that we, lost our status completely. So it was a five-year process because for asylum, you have to apply before your visa runs out, which is why she wasn't able to get it. And so that at that point, it had been 5 years of, dealing with immigration courts and lawyers and so many fees. And, as a small family coming from I'm also from Colombia, just like Maria. So we were coming from Colombia. My parents were very young. There wasn't a lot of money. So it was definitely a struggle. But they were willing to go through it because they, had this dream to live here and be here and be a part of this country and to contribute to this society.
Yes.
All right. Well, my name is Hudson, and my situation is a little bit different. My parents came over around 2005, and they came illegally through Mexico, and they were just planning to raise some money and kind of build a life back in Brazil with that money and go back just because the situation there was really bad. We're really from a really small town in northern Brazil, but they quickly realized that it was a little bit harder than they thought. So they were apart from us for 2 years, and they decided to bring us over. So my sister and I came over also illegally through the Bahamas, actually. And they were still with the same plan. They were building a house back in Brazil, buying property there with the money that they were raising here and everything, trying to build a life there. But then my dad got deported 2 years later after we got here in 2007, so 2009. And once he got deported, my mom wanted to go back, and they had a falling out and separated. And my dad basically told her that if she came back, she went back to Brazil, she would have nothing. So she chose to stay here and kind of continue, kind of start from the beginning here because we had already sent everything that we had back to Brazil. We were planning to move there. So she chose to stay here with me and my sister, and my sister and I were both able to get DACA in 2012, and it's been a really great help. But since we didn't come with a visa, we have even less options we have even less options for a path to citizenship than someone that came with a visa and overstayed their welcome because we came illegally in the first place.
So what options do you have?
The only standing option is the option of marriage. So if I were to be married to a U.S. citizen, I would be able to petition. And I actually am married. I recently married my boyfriend, and it's definitely not an easy process. But it is the only way. So now I am in the process. The process is a little bit long, and it includes a lot of fees.
What does that mean?
Well, we filed all the paperwork that's needed. We paid all the fees, and now we're just waiting for a date for the interview. So there'll be an interview where they will decide whether or not they believe that him and I are together. And I have no doubt that we'll pass that interview, but it is always up to the person's judgment, so whoever interviews us. So,
when you all are talking about fees, can you share with us an idea? Because, I mean, what are we talking? We're not talking about a $25 fee. Share with us just what these fees are.
Okay, so my family, my mom recently did a bit of a calculation, and we came in the year 2000. We have my mom, my dad, and myself, my sister, and my brother. Mm-hmm. We have a younger sister, but she's a citizen, so in the math, she doesn't really apply. Okay. So for five people, we have spent close to $100,000 in application fees and lawyer fees and everything. Just for DACA alone, it's about $500 per application per person. And you have to, at first you had to renew it every year, and then it was every 2 years. So I think I went through 4 renewals. And that was, you know, $500 each time for myself, my 2 siblings. And then my parents are in a separate category, but they still have a process similar to that. So they also have to do those same application fees. But the process to get, like, lawful permanent mm-hmm. residency, that's also very expensive. And you can't do this by yourself, so you have to hire a lawyer. And lawyers are very expensive. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they just kind of take your money and run away, which is what happened for the first, like, I want to say 6 to 8 years of our time here.
You're nodding your head. We've had similar experience?
Yes, Maria and I definitely have had very similar experiences. I don't think my family has done the calculations, but it's thousands and thousands of dollars that we have spent on lawyers' fees and immigration fees and, you know, the DACA renewals. And my parents also have a similar process, so renewals for their process. But I can say that the lawyer issue is definitely something that not enough people talk about. But, you know, there is a lot of immigration lawyers out there. Good immigration lawyers, I would argue, not a lot. But they do. They take your money and they say they're working and you believe them because, you know, you need the help. You know, you assume, okay, they're going to help me because I'm paying them.
And then how do you find out somebody's knocking on the door? How do you find out that they aren't doing what they, you know, what you have, you know, agreed to have done?
Well, I mean, in my family's case, you know, we applied for the asylum and it was a case that should have gotten asylum. And a lot of it had to do with the lawyers that we were using. They were people that were honestly not incompetent. And my parents were very young and they didn't know any better. And so they put their trust in something that was obviously not trustworthy. And the results were the asylum process was denied. And that's how we realized that the lawyers we were using were clearly not good at their job, but it was too late at that point.
That sounds harrowing. I mean, it really does, to think that you have to go through all of this and spend all this money and yet still not have competent, honest, legal representation. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and we are talking about DACA and undocumented students, and we are going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. This hour, we are looking at DACA. President Trump vowed to overturn President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA program. This grants protected status to more than 728 young dreamers who were brought to the U.S. illegally as minors. It's estimated that 1.8 million undocumented youth under the age of 18 are living in the U.S. Maria, I had to interrupt you, but you may continue.
I wanted just to add that we have to put up with all these fees, and they're incredibly expensive. But you also have to think that these are families that are probably living paycheck to paycheck because college degrees don't really transfer over well. So it's very difficult to come up with that money when you're in those situations where you don't even get any federal aid. And on top of legal fees, you have to, you know, if you are in school or in college, you have to pay for tuition out of pocket. And I mean, everyday life things happen and you have to, you know, maybe cover some medical bills and things. So it's not only is it expensive, it's almost impossible to like just come up with that money in a matter of days. And sometimes it's very difficult to have like to come up with that so people don't always get to apply for DACA or similar programs.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Sorry, I wanted to add to the whole lawyer discussion that also you have to look at it from the lawyer's point of view, because a lot of these immigration lawyers are immigrants themselves who have had to overcome a lot and don't have the same resources as a lot of other lawyers. I personally know I've only worked with one lawyer and only because I knew that she was very competent and she had, you know, the knowledge and the years of experience needed for someone to kind of maneuver through this broken system. So it can be hard. And also those lawyers that you do find that can maneuver the system are very expensive. So it's not always easy. I personally, for the marriage process, for the petitioning, that's estimated to be about $5,000 to $10,000 just for that process. And I've also had to renew DACA multiple times. And the first time I did it, I didn't really know whether or not I could do it on my own. So my mom did hire a lawyer for that as well. So that was a couple more $1,000. So with every little process, every form you fill out, there's always a fee and there's always some extra price you have to pay.
Yeah.
So that's a real challenge in itself. That's an impediment to becoming, you know, a legal citizen in the first place.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of catch-22s. The system.
Well, you're reading my mind, because the next question I want to ask all of you, what does it mean? How does it impact your life to be an undocumented student?
Well, I think personally for me, one of the hardest things has been just living under that title, because it just brings so much fear and so much uncertainty, and you never feel secure, and you don't get to vote, you don't really have a say in your elected officials, and you don't really have the power to take control of your situation, because there's nothing that I can do that's going to help my case. It's completely up to, you know, the government. So it's very difficult to live without that control over your life. And it's very traumatic to grow up and not have a sense of security and know that your parents could maybe one day just not pick you up from school because they were detained and are now in deportation process. And it's difficult too that I'm someone who would love to travel. I studied a couple of languages, and I always wanted to go, you know, put those languages to use and to really get a better, to immerse myself in other cultures. But study abroad programs that FSU has were never an option because I can't travel. If you travel, you're banned for 10 years and your process is completely, done.
Oh, wow. Well, so, I was just thinking about, what about exchange programs. All of you are in school or have been in school. You know, what if there's an exchange program? Like you say, you studied language. Maybe you had an opportunity to go to Russia for 2 months, to study. Yeah. I mean, and I say this to all of you, how does it impact your life? I mean, are you looking over your shoulder every 5 minutes? I mean, what if you're in a minor car accident?
Yeah, I think for sure sometimes it – not only the sense of security but that is threatened, but also just your sense of who you want to be as a person, because there are certain things you want to pursue in life, you know, such as traveling and seeing the world, and you can't. You just literally cannot. And, you know, I study international affairs. So for me, that's – it's so important. Mm-hmm. It's what I read about and see and learn about every day, the world. And it is really defeating sometimes when you see people that get to travel and you're like, wow, that's an incredible experience. I'm so happy for you. I wish I could have that experience too, but I cannot. And so that's definitely really hard sometimes. And a lot of people, because, you know, this is not something that I personally, you know, openly talk about. Mm-hmm. So for me, I've had a lot of people in my life that don't know that I have this, you know? And so they say, you should study abroad. You'd really love it. And, you know, all I can say to them is, yeah, I'd really love it. You know, it's very expensive. And I think about it, and I'm like, it is very expensive, but I could do it. That's not what's stopping me, though.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's little things like that that you don't really think about unless you're undocumented or, you know, you have DACA, but you have these limitations. You don't think about them. And they're sad, and sometimes it can get hard to, you know, have to confront the reality of it.
So what I hear you saying is that the life of an undocumented student, especially with this new change as far as DACA is concerned, is in jeopardy. I mean, you're in a real – you were in a vulnerable place in the first place, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, you know, now it's even more vulnerable. I mean, you can't get educational experience. You're not eligible to work. I mean, you just are kind of jammed all the way around. As they say here, you're between the rock and the hard place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's what I hear.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to add to the – they both mentioned the stigma that comes with being undocumented and that title. And I mean, I feel very lucky for having DACA. But at the same time, I do still have those limitations. And I also have had to overcome a lot to be where I am, to pay for school. You know, I've had to save money since the sophomore year of high school and all of these things. But I still – it's like I can't be proud of that. I feel like that all that hard work is kind of discredited by some people.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I have a job interview, I don't feel like I can – mention the fact that I overcame all these things, because then there's that stigma that I'm undocumented, that my parents did this illegal act. And, you know, I've been trying to own that status, you know, more and kind of show people that it just makes, you know, it makes us just better. I'm not better than anyone else, but it just makes us stronger. And it really teaches us a lot. And we've, you know, we're way stronger people because of it. But it's really hard.
But
it's hard.
And I applaud you, don't get me wrong. And I'm sure it does make you stronger. But there are other ways to get strong.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, my hat's off to you, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, unless Congress addresses the problem, DACA recipients will be eligible to be deported come the beginning early in March, like March 6th. Now, you all can tell me if I read it wrong, but that's kind of what I understood. I mean, I guess the application process for DACA stopped in September of this year, last month now.
Yeah.
And then the renewals process stopped a month later in October.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So, am I right? You can face deportation?
Yes.
Yes.
Not only have they said that you can face it, but it's actually been put out saying, like the USCIS has said, that you should expect to prepare for your exit of this country. It's almost exactly in those words. So it's not just a matter of it might happen. It's when your work permit expires, when your DACA ends, and you didn't have the chance to renew, you should expect them to be out looking for you, because you gave the government your information in good faith, and it wasn't supposed to be shared with the agency that can, you know, take legal actions against you. But with the rescindment, it's a possibility, and it seems like it will.
Yeah, I mean, because when you apply, you put down addresses. And it just seems, so
everything.
What's going to stop them? I mean, so let's say Congress doesn't address this, and we'll get to Congress too, but what's going to stop them when they knock on the door of taking everyone in the home?
Yeah. Personally, I'd like to think.
Are we being overreactive? I mean, just tell
them. No, I don't.
And it's
absolutely.
Not. And it's not just us.
Definitely
it's
not.
We have parents. We have family.
Yes.
The address that I put down for my application is my mom's address.
Yeah.
I don't want that to be provided to anyone. I don't want anyone knocking on her door. So it's not like we're just watching over our own shoulders, but we're having to take care of our families and worried that we're going to be the reason they get deported. So
yeah, And definitely with the whole Congress thing, one of the most important things is that, yes, Congress might be able to help us out as, you know, DACA recipients, but that's not all, you know? Like, we don't want our families – we don't want to be helped out ourselves and have our families be left behind, because that's just unacceptable. And
I read for the listening audience, do you know that 73% of DACA recipients have a U.S. citizen in the family?
Yeah.
Okay, and I think that's something that's kind of downplayed, because you're talking about splitting up families. You're also talking about sending someone to a geographical location that you may know nothing about. If you've grown up here, if you've been here since you were 4 or since you were 5, or how can you go back to Colombia? Back to, you really weren't there. I mean, am I making sense?
Yeah.
Yes, and definitely. I can't imagine my life there anymore. I had my uncle is a U.S. citizen, but he ended up marrying another lady in Colombia, and she had a great job there. She has a great job there. So he moved for her, and he still visits, like, all the time, almost, like, 4 or 5 times a year, because he just cannot get acclimated into the Colombian lifestyle anymore, because over here it's so peaceful, it's so nice.
It's
a
different world.
Basically, yeah. And not saying that Colombia isn't a great place, but it's a very different world. And I can't. I mean, I speak Spanish, but maybe at an elementary, middle school level, so I can't compete.
There is one opportunity for us to leave the country, and that's through advanced parole. Well, not anymore, since the announcement. We can't apply for advanced parole anymore. But with advanced we can leave the country. We have permission to come back into the country as long as we're leaving either for a family emergency, like a family member is dying, which that was my case, or for educational purposes or for work. And I went to Brazil for a few days to visit my family members, and I just felt like a foreigner. People looked at me weird. When I ordered food at a restaurant, they looked at me like I was a foreigner. Like I have that accent, and it didn't feel like home. It didn't feel like I was in my country. It's my culture, but I don't. It's not.
Well, it's like, should all black folks go back to Africa? I mean, it's the same, you know, basically, really, it's the same thing, okay? Because that might be our country of origin. I mean, come on. I'd be lost. These policies, do they send a message to you? What message do they send? I mean, Trump, when he campaigned, he was going to get rid of DACA. Oh, he was going to send all these folks back. And then he started kind of, after he won, he started wavering back and forth. But what message do you all get? I'm just wondering, do you get a message at all?
I get the message that we're a playing card. I feel like, I mean, I don't know if you read up on the list that he kind of provided. I hear my lawyer actually makes these videos on Facebook kind of explaining all the latest news on this. And she was saying that it is one of the most concise lists they've ever provided. And it actually does have they actually explain what they want. But what they want is just to use us as a playing card.
Right.
They want money for the wall. They want more immigration judges. They want more immigration courts. They want
more enforcement.
Yeah, they want to deport millions of people.
Yeah,
and that's something that I'm not really willing to sacrifice, I guess, because I don't want to just say, yeah, sure, pass something that benefits me, but throw everybody else under the bus. Because how are you going to do that when a lot of people who would have deserved something like DACA didn't qualify because there were so many requirements that were difficult to meet? And if you didn't meet one but you met all other, like, how many ever, then it's not fair for me to say I'm better than you and I deserve this more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For me, it kind of just especially hearing it, you know, from the president, from higher level officials, as someone who studies politics and government, I know what that means, and I know the power that those words hold. And so for me, it's just kind of like I feel like I belong here, but he's telling me I don't. And I know I don't belong where I'm from. Mm-hmm. So where do I belong? What kind of a limbo am I stuck in right now? And why, you know, why are we, like they said, why are we like a piece in a chess match when we're people, we're humans? We have, obviously, we all have stories. Mm-hmm. And so I think they look at it and they just see numbers.
The other thing is, you all aren't even citizens, okay? What about, I know I'm digressing a little bit, but Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands, they are citizens, okay? And look how they've been treated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely a message of, like, we're better than y'all. There's a division, and it's clear. And it's sad because we don't need to be dividing our country anymore. I think it would be great if we could all just, like, seriously just come together. Like, it's been in so many polls, it's proven that a majority of the U.S. citizens support something that pass, like the DREAM Act to pass that gives you a pathway to citizenship. And I don't understand the hesitation. I don't understand why there's so much like want to divide and to separate us into different categories.
You really don't understand? Or are you just not saying? I mean, I'm wondering, is it really that you don't understand?
Yeah.
I mean, just speaking candidly, or, you know, is it more convenient just not to address it? Because I don't know.
There is a white nationalist-y feel to all of it.
I definitely think that I think the divide and conquer mentality is what's driving all of this. Mm-hmm. Because if he can divide the country and conquer certain sections of it and, you know, empower those sections, whether they're, you know, these things like white nationalism and all of that, it gives those people that want that power, it gives them the power that they've been looking for.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we will return momentarily.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. This hour, we're talking about DACA. DACA is not a law. It's a presidential executive authority, which means it can be changed based on the president. It can be terminated or not renewed based on the discretion of the Department of Homeland Security. It opens up the space to qualify for post-secondary education benefits, and it also allows people to be in the United States legally. They can obtain Social Security and work. I had to interrupt you. Who you want to share?
I was just going to finish up that statement by saying that by empowering these groups, they're doing it at the expense of everybody else that is being affected.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. That's exactly what's happening. And as you mentioned, Trump had said, he would consider fixing the legislation if it passed as a broader immigration initiative, okay? One that would overall and strengthen the border. Mm-hmm. That's another way of what you were saying. You know, so we'll put up the wall. Anyhow, when this wall, I mean, when I think about what I'm talking and saying to you all, it's so ridiculous.
Yeah,
it is.
You know?
I think the most ridiculous part is the fact that him and his, and anyone else in power like him, they're just lying to their base. They're saying that they're trying to get rid of criminals. Well, 0% of DACA recipients have a felony.
Yeah. I know you can't have a felony.
Exactly. So they're saying that they're trying to get rid of us because we're taking the benefits from everyone else. We can't have welfare. We can't have all of these benefits that their base really believe we're taking away from them.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of immigrants, you know, they make small businesses. So we're not taking away anyone's benefits. And then on top of that, we're adding jobs to the economy that people don't think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I see it that way. But his supporters say, you know, that you all can harm the economy. Okay, and that you're taking jobs away. Who said that? Session mm-hmm. was saying, oh, they're taking jobs away from Americans that would have these jobs otherwise.
Well,
and how do people buy that?
That's not even true, because a lot of times too, that it's jobs that nobody else wants to put up with. I think it was North Carolina that did it wasn't necessarily an experiment, but they had a law that the farms there, the farm owners had to hire U.S. citizens before anybody else. Well, U.S. citizens, most of them didn't show up. Uh-huh. And then the majority who did show up didn't even make it the first day. And then there was only like one person who stuck it out the whole season. So what jobs are we taking that you would actually want? Yeah. And then even if you deport us all, not only are you losing like
how are you going to deport, 11 million people?
Yeah.
How are you going to orchestrate this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who's going to pay for that? Who's going to pay for the wall? When you ran on lowering the national debt, where is that money coming from?
And another thing is that, you know, undocumented immigrants still pay taxes.
That's true.
So
that's a good point.
We are giving this money, and we're obviously not getting the benefits of that because, you know, paying taxes towards things that we can't ever get until we get citizenship. So that's also a loss of money that the United States is going to have to incur, you know, if they try to take us out of here, that we pay taxes and those taxes are not going to be paid if we're not here, if we're not living here.
Yeah, and on the subject of taxpayers' money, one of the things on that list of requests was actually a request for 100 new immigration lawyers to work on all of these deportation cases. Well, that's 100 lawyers that the government has to pay. Mm-hmm. They have to pay their salaries every year, and you know, a lawyer salary is not low. So it's hiring more ICE agents, hiring more USCIS agents, all these things that's taxpayers' money mm-hmm. That's being taken away.
What's going to happen? I mean, I know you don't know what's going to happen, but what's the status of things? Where are things at? I mean, do you have any idea?
I think there's a good chance that something will pass in Congress. I had the opportunity to go to D.C.
Oh, really?
And speak to congressmen. It was through Forward U.S., and they just organized like a day for 100 Dreamers to go, and it was on October 5th, so the day, a month after the decision to end the program. But we were able to talk to our congressmen and members, women and men.
What was the reception? How did they receive you?
I think most of them were pretty nice, and they said, we support you. We believe that there should be something.
Of course, I guess they wouldn't say to your face, we don't.
Well, you know, there were stories of some that were straight up saying, no, we do not support this. But for the most part, it was them saying, we do support you, we want something to pass, but we're just working on all the amendments to it. You know,
did they elaborate?
Not too much, but they did say there are other bills out there. It's not just the DREAM Act, there's the RAC Act and SUCCEED Act. Mm-hmm. You know, there are other things, but they're just trying to work together and come up with some bipartisan thing that works for everyone, but the negotiations are what's kind of slowing it down.
Well, they don't have a long time because we're talking about March.
Yeah. And this isn't their only issue. So they don't have a whole lot of time to do all of these things, and they have so many other issues that people are really worried about. And honestly, our path to citizenship is not, most Americans don't really care about, what's going on with us. They might want something to happen, but they're not doing anything because it doesn't directly affect them. So I feel like Congress will try to get something worked out, but they just won't have the time and they won't be able to focus on this issue.
What people listening to this program who do want to support you, okay, who do understand what's happening? What can they do? I mean, what would you say to them? What can they do? I mean, I personally don't know. So you tell me. It seems like, oh yeah, they could talk to the Congress, you know, men or women, Congressperson, and let them know how much they support this. But what else can they do?
I think that's pretty much it.
Go to town hall meetings, any way to kind of convey to their congressmen that they support Dreamers and that they support any legislation that would create a path to citizenship with us, for us. Anything that communicates that to a congressperson would help a lot, and that's the only thing they can really do.
And also, I think this is another thing that's kind of indirect, but it helps. And I think that people who really want to support this cause can donate to advocacy groups, you know, nonprofits. They are a lot of the people who are doing the work of going to these congressmen's offices and telling them personal stories and sending people like Maria to go there. And so, of course, call your congressman. That's the most important thing, and women, congressmen and women.
Can you share, all of you, maybe one or two advocacy groups that you are aware of that people can you know, do their homework on further, take it a step further and support?
The one that I mentioned was forward.us.
Okay.
That's FWD.us.
And can you talk about it? Tell us about it.
They are they're a bipartisan group. They work on a lot of immigration issues, and it's kind of like trying to speak with representatives and just kind of help the agenda that they have, which right now is kind of more for the DREAM Act. But they do a great job of involving other, like, actual Dreamers, and they have a lot of PR. And I don't know. I mean, the whole trip to Washington, D.C. wouldn't have been possible, you know, without, like, spendable money. So definitely helps.
Okay.
That's my.
And now, do you have any other groups?
Yeah, there's one called Define American, which was made by Jose Antonio Vargas, who is the journalist who, you know, came out as a Dreamer on the Time cover, which was a big thing a while back. And it was founded by him, and that group is also an advocacy group that works with immigration.
Okay. And, you know, I think about resources, but I guess at this point, given everything is in limbo, I mean, DACA is in limbo, and it seems like it's headed to purgatory to me. You know, I mean, it just seems like, it's just incredulous. Honestly, you probably can tell I'm just kind of like at a loss for words, and I've always got something to say. But it's just so, you know, it's hard to just imagine what can happen. Okay?
Yeah.
Have any of you personally experienced any difficulty with immigration, Homeland Security, ICE, any of those kinds of situations?
I mean, the closest thing for me was my parents were had a court hearing in 2012 where it was going to be decided whether they were going to be put into deportation proceedings or not. Fortunately, the judge in our case stood up for my parents, and he administratively closed the case. So that was him stopping that because they were on the path, basically, to be deported. That was difficult because you never want to have, you know, the thought that your parents are going to be deported, your family separated, but...
Any other situations?
I can't remember the year, but when I was, so 5 years ago, I'd say, because I was 15, ICE actually came to my house and, you know, they detained my father in the middle of the night.
Can you share what they do? I mean, what do they really?
Literally, they just knock on the door very loudly, and my parents were like, it's the middle of the night, this is probably something important. Then I realized it was ICE because they don't always look. You know, they're not always wearing, like, an identifiable uniform or anything.
Oh,
they opened the door.
They
were literally, they were wearing, like, yeah, they were wearing, but it was, like, cargo pants and, like, a like a black shirt.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, you know, you can't tell the, right away that's someone that's like law enforcement of some kind. And we open the door, and once you open the door to immigration, that's it. That's it. You can't turn back from that.
Do they have the right to – they don't knock down the door?
No, they don't. So you have to open it.
So if you had – if they hadn't opened the door.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we found out later that they had actually been following our family for a while, just kind of seeing what we were doing, our schedules and stuff, to see at which point they could get to us, you know? And at that point, my mom was allowed to stay because my sister, she's an American citizen, and she was like – 5 or 6 at that point. She was, you know, a little baby, and I was 15. So obviously we had no one to care for us. Mm-hmm. So my mom was allowed to stay, but my dad was detained for some time, and that was very difficult for our family.
And oh, I'm sure.
It definitely, I would say, as Maria said earlier, it definitely traumatized me, you know, because one of the things that I'm very aware of is that my parents go through all of this, and they continue to go through all of this for my sake. Yeah. My sister's an American citizen. My parents, you know, they love this country as much as I do. But they could go back. They lived in their country for 25 years. Mm-hmm. They could go back. But it's me that they stay for, and it's me that they fight for. And so that for me as a 15-year-old, to come to terms with the fact that, you know, they were doing it for me, that was difficult. It was very difficult.
I was just going to share. I had a similar experience with my dad, too, when I was 12. And he also got deported. He worked the apartment complex we lived in, actually hired him, as one of their maintenance people. And so they knocked on the door, and they actually had someone else knock on the door and say someone was stuck in the elevator so that he could go help them. And as soon as he walked out the door, the ICE agents came up and arrested him.
Yeah.
My mom immediately closed the door, and so she wasn't detained. I was asleep. I didn't find out about this until hours later. And I was, I don't know, you can't
so
even
visit.
I couldn't
kind
even
of
visit
him. Underhanded.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Types of
and
tactics.
Even though they're not allowed to knock down the door, sometimes they do.
Yeah.
So it's never by the rules.
Who's going to stop them, honestly?
Yeah, no one at the house can stop them. Yeah. They're looking for you.
Yeah.
I do want to say that my dad did not get deported. I had a situation where, you know, after some time of being detained, you know, he went through like a little court thing as well.
And what was that detainment? I know you weren't there, but what was that detainment?
He was wearing an orange jumpsuit. He looked like he was in jail. And it was, for a 15-year-old to see that, it was like, my dad didn't do anything wrong.
Could you go visit him?
I did
visit
him.
Family members could go?
Yes.
It was safe to
visit? my mom and I visited, and my little sister did not. She never really knew what happened. She was too little, and we never told her because, you know, why break her heart? She's definitely a daddy's girl. So, but I went, and it was like going to a jail, and, you know, it was a detention center. But those places are run like jails. So
actually, sometimes they're
worse. And sometimes they're worse than jails.
Like Lumpkin has a detention center, and it's probably one of the worst places you could ever be.
And that's why it was traumatizing, because it was – I knew my dad did nothing wrong. And so to see him in that position and to see him – you know, defeated but still fighting. And I was like, how do you keep going? This, like, I feel like this is the lowest it can get, and yet you're still like, I'm gonna get out of here for you, you know?
Yeah. And when they come to your door, they can come back because they know your address. So
they came back for my mom
about 2 months later. They came back and knocked on our door, and they were knocking very loudly. They went to all the windows, knocked on the windows. We didn't open no matter what. And the next we stayed indoors for about 24 hours, kind of scared to even go outside. And we had, you know, my sister's boyfriend at the time was a U.S. citizen. So we had him, like, check the entrance of of our apartment complex before we left. And we went and found a one-bedroom apartment to live in for a year because we didn't feel safe in our own home.
Yeah.
Wow.
In this last minute and a half or so, how do you think we should deal with the immigration issue?
I have many suggestions.
Go.
Well, I think obviously Congress. Congress needs to, you know, get on that and pass a law. Mm-hmm. Like, they need to. There's no other option. There's too many other factors that make this practically impossible to deport 11 million people.
Oh, yeah.
But on top of that, I think regular people listening to the show and, you know, people anywhere can just you know, be more aware of who they're surrounded by, because a lot of times you don't even know that you're friends with someone who's undocumented, and you don't even know the life experiences that they've had. And to open your mind and your heart to that story, and it's not easy to tell a story like that. That's important.
Any words of wisdom that you would offer to younger undocumented students who are following behind you, how they handle it?
Okay. Keep going. When they go low, we go high.
Yeah. Don't give up.
Surround yourself with people that will support you. And, you know, if you're looking for a job, find a company that will support you in your endeavors and will support your fight.
Well, I want to really extend my sincere appreciation for you coming. I think, you know, I appreciate you sharing your experiences. That's it for this hour. Many thanks to my audience for the privilege of their time and their ear. And to my panelists, thank you so much. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.